beautiful singing you have here. I wish I could be a part of this all the time. It's wonderful. And great song leaders. Just an exalted privilege to be here, participate in that. We live in what is becoming more and more so a biblically illiterate society. I can say that definitely being on the West Coast, but I think all of American society is becoming more and more so that way. I can remember way back when I was in high school converting the first person that I had ever taught the gospel using the Jewel Miller Tex Stevens film strip series way back when. And then when I was in college, at Florida College, my future wife had a friend at University of South Florida. I'd gone through that Jewel Miller Tex Stevens film strip series, and we had gone through five of those sessions. I was all ready to baptize him, and he informed me that to him, God was only a concept. And I got to thinking, well, I've got to back up a few steps here. Taught me a valuable lesson that this shared heritage, a respect for biblical authority that I kind of took for granted growing up, and that I even assumed into the first few years of my preaching life, was rapidly becoming a thing of the past. And at this point in my life, I've been able to teach the gospel to people from virtually every corner of the earth. For one, because we've got people from everywhere where I live in Santa Clara. But we've also gone some places, some exotic places. As many of you know, I was a widower. My wife was a widow, widowed preacher's wife. And Robert Smith and Andrea started the church in Seychelles. You had some members here that had gone there a few years ago, but halfway around the world. And about 3 years ago, we went to do some work to solidify the church and to teach lost souls. And Andrea's daughter, Deb, had a friend, Abdel, who had grown up under the basketball tutelage of Robert, and was a professional basketball player in France. His dream was to play in the NBA. And we were talking with him about the gospel. I had done my little Ecclesiastes lesson that I so often do with non-Christians. And he showed some interest, and I said, well, next time we're going to talk about Jesus. And he kind of asked a question. It's the first time I'd ever been asked it. You mean he has something to do with all this? Was his question. It had never occurred to him. He'd grown up in something of a Muslim family and never really been exposed at all to Jesus. I haven't run into too many people in my life who don't know much of anything about Jesus, but his question just kind of struck me. You mean he has something to do with all this? That was kind of like a light bulb, a revelation for him. And more and more, I'm finding and I'm running into people that don't have the foggiest clue about Jesus. Now, that's not a good thing, but it's the world in which we are increasingly living. I'm talking this week about the new covenant made in Jesus' blood. And in the next two nights, I'm going to establish how that we enter into a new covenant relationship with God. I'm going to talk about that at some degree of length using the background that I established yesterday about what a covenant is and how there are nuts and bolts of entering into a covenant, signs of the covenant, and a formal process in which one enters into a covenant relationship with God. But the truth of the matter is, not everybody accepts the new covenant of Jesus Christ. And so the question may be posed, if a person doesn't accept the new covenant, does he get a free pass? And the answer is absolutely not. Bible is very clear about that. And so tonight we're going to talk about those who are condemned even outside of that covenant relationship, if you will. John Blanchard said, "There is no such thing as a little sin because there is no such person as a little God to sin against." D.A. Carson says, "The dimensions of evil are established by the dimensions of God. The ugliness of evil is established by the beauty of God. The filth of evil is established by the purity of God. The selfishness of evil is established by the love of God." And so we're going to talk about the condemnation of a lost world. But again, I want to emphasize this point. I believe that all men are, on one level, amenable to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I'm going to take it that you believe that as well. But there are some fundamental differences between those who have a covenant relationship with God and those who don't. In terms of nature of the beast. Ephesians 2 verse 12, for example, in speaking of the old covenant, and historically the Gentiles who were coming into Christ for the first time in the first century, Paul says, "Remember that at that time you were separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world." And I want to underscore strangers to the covenants of promise. They were outside of God's covenants with His chosen people, the Israelites. And as one commentator so aptly put it in defining and commenting on Ephesians 2:12, the Gentile world was Christless, stateless, hopeless, and godless. I think that's a good commentary on Ephesians 2:12. There's another passage that one of my mentors long ago at Florida College brought to my attention, Phil Roberts. He pointed out from Amos chapter 1 and 2 that you have kind of a wholesale condemnation of the Gentile world all around the Judahites and the Israelites. And it starts with Syria, then goes to Philistia, and then the Edomites, and then the Ammonites and the Moabites. And they're all condemned. They're condemned by Amos there. But they're condemned for their atrocities. They're condemned for acts of inhumanity, for murder, for slavery, for unspeakable evils that they inflict on other people. But then you get to the middle of chapter 2, or about verse 4 of chapter 2 on, and you finally get to Judah and then Israel, and it kind of zeroes in on Israel ultimately. But when you get to God's chosen people historically, the Judahites and the Israelites, they're not condemned just for their atrocities. They're condemned for violation of covenant. There's a different basis of condemnation there at work. They have a covenant. They have all the advantages. And they're condemned because even though they have a covenant relationship with God, they have totally violated it. Been unfaithful to that covenant relationship that they have with Almighty God. This is kind of how I've understood this over the years. I may not be totally right. This is an oversimplification. But I believe that God has always had a certain baseline of expectations of human beings, morally and spiritually. It's always been right to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. It's always been right to love your neighbor as yourself. Adultery, murder, lying, theft, and the like have always been wrong. And embedded are those basic principles of right and wrong in the various patriarchal covenants that God makes from time immemorial. Embedded are those basic moral principles in the Sinai covenant, and perhaps we could say that the perfect expression of them is found in the gospel of Christ in the New Testament, the New Covenant. But that inherent baseline of human expectation has always been there. It's what R.L. Whiteside calls in his commentary on Romans the universal rule of right and wrong. But the Gentile world did not have the law of Moses. They didn't have a covenant relationship with God
to the same extent that the Israelites had. Maybe you could argue that, you know, through Adam and the earliest patriarchs, they had little vestiges of that revelation. I certainly believe that that is true. But they didn't have the same relationship with God, the covenant relationship with God the Israelites had. And therefore, on what basis were they condemned? How could they even be condemned for all these atrocities if they didn't have basic law? You look at the book of Romans, which we're going to look at some length tonight. Chapter 5 and verse 13 of the book of Romans says, "For sin was indeed in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law." Law marks out sin to be what it truly is in the eyes of God. Chapter 4, verse 15. Chapter 4, verse 15 says, "For the law brings wrath, but where there is no law, there is no transgression." But the Gentile world as a whole, up to this point in human history, as Paul writes this, did not have a special covenant relationship that the Israelites had. They didn't have the Ten Commandments on tablets of stone. They didn't have the tabernacle or the temple. They didn't have the law of Moses. What advantage then has the Jew? Much in every way. First of all, they have the oracles of God, Paul says in chapter 3, 1 and 2 of Romans. Gentile world didn't have the oracles of God in the same sense. Were they entirely without law? Did they have an excuse? You secular people today have an excuse. How about people who are totally ignorant about the Bible? How about people who even ask the question, does Jesus have anything to do with this? Do they have an excuse? Let me first of all suggest, and I want to make these next few slides simple. The gospel is a solution to a problem, and it is not the cause of the problem. The gospel of Jesus Christ did not get us into this mess. It's the solution to the mess. Another way of looking at that is the gospel is the medicine for disease, but it's not the cause of the disease. The gospel is the antidote for a poison, but it's not the source of the poison or the reason the poison is in our system to begin with. The gospel is the remedy for a need, but it's not the reason the need exists in the first place. If a man is on a cruise ship and he goes overboard and he's out in the ocean in desperate plight and someone throws out the lifeline as his only hope, the lifeline is not the cause of his predicament. The fact that he's in the ocean to begin with is the cause of his predicament. The gospel is the solution, not the problem. And so when we look at the remedy and the need, as Paul establishes those things in the book of Romans, when he talks about the remedy in chapter 1, 16 and 17, he says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." That's the remedy. But the need is established in the first three chapters of Romans. The fact that we're all lost in sin. Verse 9 of chapter 3, "What then, are Jews, are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are all under sin." And he says in chapter 11, verse 32, "For God has consigned all to disobedience, that he might have mercy upon all." Well, on what basis then? On what basis were the Gentiles condemned here? It's interesting that you have in verse 18 of Romans chapter 1, right after Paul says that the gospel is a revelation of God for salvation, he says that the wrath of God is revealed in verse 18. The gospel reveals the righteousness of God, but the wrath of God is also revealed, and you have a juxtaposition between the two. The place of revelation from heaven, that's the source, against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And what makes the crime so offensive is that men suppress the truth in unrighteousness. In other words, they're not innocent victims of something that someone else perpetrated upon them. There's willful ignorance about this.
We could take a lot of examples, and I'll give you one that's really a hot button issue in our society. Gay marriage. And I don't know how the Supreme Court's going to rule on that. I do know that the polls a few years ago swung wildly in one direction, and now they're tending to go pretty firmly in the other direction. And there's a recent Gallup poll that shows about 80% of young people, college-aged, are pro. Never would have believed that a few years ago. But I want to tell you something. I believe that most people know intuitively, deep down, or they have every reason to know, that marriage is God's intellectual property. And you don't mess with God's intellectual property and get away with it for very long. There are good reasons to come to the conclusion that you see that Jesus even establishes in Matthew 19 when he goes back to Genesis 2, and you have one man and one woman for life, and they're both human beings, which rules out bestiality. He is a man, she is a woman, that rules out homosexuality. And they're joined together, which rules out any third-party infringement of adultery. And I work with people from all over the world. I work with Indians and Chinese, South Americans and Africans. And one of the fun things about doing that, and interesting things, I suppose, is that it has occurred to me that human beings pretty much have a pretty good handle on the fact that adultery happens to be wrong. And most people know intuitively that homosexuality is not exactly the way we're made. Most people intuitively know that. But something is suppressed. There's some willful ignorance and a whole lot of education in the wrong direction, manipulating people to try to think a certain way on that issue. And we need to be aware of that. There's a knowledge of God. And the warrant for the indictment is found in verses 19 through the end of the chapter of chapter 1 of Romans. And I'll go ahead and read the whole thing and make a few comments on it. Read it with me if you will. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them, for His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. That's a heavy passage. But it looks more and more like our society every day. I hate to say it.
The warrant for the indictment is that what is knowable about God is evident. By all right-thinking people, people know deep down that there is a God and that He holds us accountable. Even without the oracles of God, chapter 3, verse 2, the Gentile world is far from total ignorance about God. According to this passage that we've just read, they know God well enough to reject Him. They know God well enough to exchange the glory of God for idolatrous images, verse 23. They know God well enough to exchange the truth about God for a lie, verse 25. In fact, they know God well enough to hate Him, to become haters of God, verse 30. They know God well enough to know that the decree of God is against all these sins, and yet they approve them anyway and give their approval to others who commit these things. I don't think we give the lost world enough credit. They're responsible for their own pitiable condition, and we have nothing to be ashamed of in the public forums, anywhere on earth, to stand up and speak the truth when it is suppressed by our society. In fact, the lost world knows God's invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature, verse 20. These things have been clearly perceived, Paul says, which implies that human beings have the capacity for inference, of connecting the dots, dotting the I's, crossing the T's. They're able to see cause and effect relationships. For ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, they can see what is here and draw those conclusions, see the cosmological argument that is intuitive to our nature, that what exists must have an adequate cause, that must be greater, far more powerful, and personal behind what exists. In fact, I believe there are people who have read Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and other atheists like them, who are struggling really, really hard to completely eradicate God from their program of thinking, and they're thinking about God a whole lot more than we give them credit for, because they, for some reason, they can't get God out of their system. And what Paul says is that they're without excuse. Without apology, without defense, without excuse, there is no excuse for knowing about God and a failure to honor Him as God. No excuse. And even when we're dealing with people who are not in covenant relationship with God, we need to stop giving them a free pass for what they ought to know and what they do know deep down, what they're suppressing about all of that. But there's a progression that occurs. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but became futile in their thinking, and their foolish heart was darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. You talk about steps to a godless society. You've got them right here. The process starts in the mind, and then there are some consequences that result from that. And Paul identifies those consequences. Moral depravity. Immoral behavior, let me suggest to you, is not the cause of the world's woes. It's the result. The cause is a sickness of mind that results in a certain kind of behavior. A spiritual condition starts in the mind. The catalyst behind it all is an improper attitude toward God. Therefore, God gives them up. He hands them over to impure lust, dishonorable passions, and to a debased mind. And the ultimate consequence of that debasement is self-destruction in idolatry and immorality. according to verses 28 through 31. Someone has said, sin is man's declaration of independence from God. And I suppose that is a good definition of sin. That's where it starts. But people's thinking is warped, and then their behavior becomes warped because God allows them to fall into a cesspool of total depravity. When they reject God and His glory, there's no reasonable stopping point. Once those parameters have been removed, there's no stopping point to it. Depravity in idolatry and immorality. And all this without being in a covenant relationship with God. And not having at least recent access to God's revelations. Paul says that essentially in the gist of his argument is people know. People know right from wrong, generally speaking at least. Galatians 5:19, the works of the flesh are manifest. They are evident. They know these things are wrong. Unrighteousness, Romans 1, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness, gossip, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. People become so embedded in their thought process that anyone who's not, or these things, these truths I'm talking about are so embedded in our thought process that anyone who's not warped knows these things are wrong. They know that they're wrong. And again, I've studied with people from virtually every cultural and linguistic background. And I'm just amazed at the commonalities that I see among human beings of widely different backgrounds. But there's another basis of judgment that enters into the fray here at the very end of chapter 1, the beginning of chapter 2. A new idea, if you will. Their judgment is warped, but they still pass judgment. First of all, there's approval. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they give approval to those who practice them. And I would urge the young people here, through all the indoctrination that you would tend to get on a college campus, and in Texas A&M, I'm sure is different than a lot of campuses, or maybe not. But don't ever approve blatant sin, or you will be held accountable for it. Don't allow a professor to skew your thinking in that regard. But there's not only approval, there's disapproval as well. The very next verse. And some have assumed that and maybe rightly so, that Paul switches gears from Gentiles to Jews. That may be the case, and it may not be the case. He goes on to say, therefore you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the very same thing. Whether he switches gears from Jew to Gentile or not, I do know that both Jews and Gentiles have found themselves in the judging business. They not only give approval where there's no approval to be found, they give disapproval to certain kinds of behavior as well. In fact, we live in a society that prides itself on toleration of almost everything except intolerance, but I found that the preachers of tolerance in our society are some of the most intolerant people on the face of the earth when someone makes a movie, writes a book, takes a stand, or engages in free speech that they don't like. They're some of the most intolerant people toward Christians. And everybody on the face of this earth draws a line somewhere. It may be murdering a homosexual. Well, that's wrong. And it is wrong. But everybody draws the line somewhere with actions that are not just inappropriate or a difference of opinion, but wrong.
And here's what I think about that with regard to the world in general that rejects the Bible. Everybody knows, even without the Bible, that some things are right and other things are wrong. Everybody intuitively makes those judgments all the time. They make reciprocal judgments about people. And everybody ultimately knows adultery, pornography, stealing, cheating, and so on. Nothing new under the sun in that regard. But Paul goes on to say, for in what you judge others, you judge yourself. And he cites essentially what is a universal principle that one should act toward others as you would want them to act towards you. And the specifications of this principle are revealed most clearly in the judgments a person makes of others. The reason I know that what Paul says here is so true is because everybody I know, everybody I've ever known, makes judgments. And when they're making judgments about moral behavior, they're essentially saying there is a moral law that applies to everybody. I've never known a person that tries to live life as if there is ultimately no ultimate law that applies to anybody. That'd be a scary person to deal with. The person is essentially saying, by judging, that this behavior is not acceptable, not tolerable, out of bounds. Now, people draw that line at different points, but ultimately, everybody draws a line. Everybody does. But here's the thing. The righteous judgments of God that Gentiles know are demonstrated in the fact that they pass judgment on others. That essentially proves Paul's point, but specific condemnation of others boomerangs because people become hypocrites in the process of judging others. And everybody at one point or another in his life who says, that's wrong, points one finger the other direction, has three fingers pointing back toward himself. And because people engage in behavior that they admit it is wrong. In fact, I would dare say everybody in this room has done that at one point or other in your life. And the worst scoundrel you know has done that. And that's the point. So people sin, even without... And
the Gentiles that Paul is speaking of here sinned, even without revealed law in the form of a Bible on their bookshelf. So he says in Romans 2, 12 and 13, for all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. All who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. My first question there is, how can you sin without the law? According to many passages in Romans, such as Romans 7, the function of the Old Testament law was to make sin apparent, to mark it out, to show sin, to be exceedingly sinful. But again, even without revealed law, some things are still fundamentally right, some things are fundamentally wrong. God's basic moral law, if you will. A criminal gets a slap on the wrist by a judge. Legislators are outraged. They pass another law to criminalize the activity. Many countries have Good Samaritan laws, where a passerby is required to report a crime in progress. An extension of that are the so-called duty to rescue laws, which are a form of tort law in which a party can be held liable for failing to come to the aid of another person in peril. You remember a famous case where that law came into play in a very godless country known as France? Lady Diana, some years ago, Princess Diana, had this terrible automobile accident. And France passed a law after all that up to 5 years imprisonment and fine up to $100,000. And that is now criminalized on the law books of France. Why was it criminalized? Let me suggest to you, because everybody in his right mind knows, even without that law on the law books,
that it's wrong for paparazzi to take pictures of a dying subject rather than to come to her aid. Everybody knows that. Or they ought to.
Now that's a weak analogy, but it serves my point here. That the Gentiles who didn't have the law of Moses and the covenant the Israelites had were still held accountable for the same kinds of atrocities.
They became a law to themselves, Paul says. Romans 2, 14 and 15.
But when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. By nature, when they do what the law requires, I understand by nature to be in keeping with customs, culture, conscience, still influenced faintly by God's earliest revelation to mankind. You probably have heard or may have heard of preachers going to China and showing the Chinese characters that describe pictures of the early accounts of Genesis. And we have a lot of Chinese folks in my part of the country, and I do the same thing with them.
It's fascinating, but you can show the story of the flood, the creation account, sacrificial system. Many early accounts in the book of Genesis are embedded in that pictorial system that goes back thousands of years. Somehow the ancient Chinese knew about some of those episodes. And I would suggest to you that many of those things are still embedded in the human culture and law, traces of God's earliest revelations to mankind. And that human beings who think with any sense of right and wrong know the basics of morality, at least. The work of the law, what Paul calls the work of the law. They know intuitively the basic standards of right and wrong. The law of Moses had an essential core, reflecting a universal standard. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not lie. Do not covet. And so on and so on. But people in their right thinking know these things. They always have. In theory, at least, Gentiles could justify themselves by good behavior if they behave 100% of the time. But in practice, they fall short of perfect obedience. Even in those areas they know to be right. They fall short because they feel guilty, and they feel guilty because they are guilty. When they are a law to themselves, they are self-condemned hypocrites, and the entire world is under that sentence. The entire world. Which is why people need Jesus. Everyone needs the gospel. We have a hodgepodge where I live. You got Muslims, Hindus, and professed Christians who aren't really Christians, and Sikhs, and virtually everything under the sun. But everybody needs Jesus. Everybody. Because none of these other faiths deal with the sin problem. Only Jesus does. And only Jesus offers you a covenant with his own blood that purchased it. And so he says in John 12:48, he who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has one who judges him. The word that I have spoken, the same will judge him in the last day. He says in John 8:24, I told you, you would die in your sins. For unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. He says in John 14, verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. So going back to Abdel's question, halfway around the world, you mean Jesus has something to do with all this? He has everything to do with it. And he's offering you a covenant. You can get right with God and get all these sins forgiven. And become the person that God has always dreamed that you become. And whether you acknowledge it or not, you're going to give account to Him one day.
And whether you do it now or later, you're going to confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God the Father one day. But it would be a whole lot more advantageous to do it now. Because one day it will be too late. If you're subject to the gospel call of Jesus Christ, you need to obey that gospel. You need to name His name publicly. You need to be baptized for the remission of your sins. There's no better time than now.
But make no mistake about it. God will hold you accountable. And the only way to get rid of your sin problem is through Jesus.